Welcome to the Deer Talk Now podcast. I am David Gillane, and I'm here with my guest, Dan Schmidt. And I'm just kidding. Actually, I'm not the host. He's the host. I'm the guest. I'm actually just here to kind of fill in as a Diane Sawyer, Walter Cronkite type of thing, because as you, if you're watching, you see on the TV, it says How the Whitetail Industry Began with David Gillane. I will tell you right now, I am the least authoritative person on this. I'm pretty sure it began about 30 well, maybe 10, 15 years before I did. To introduce myself a little bit, Dan and I go back a whole 6 years, right?
6 years.
And what did we first find that we had in common? It wasn't hunting, because I don't hunt, or I didn't hunt. I do now. You and my dad went to high school together. That was kind of a wild ride, right?
Yep.
That's
yep.
When I knew I had the job.
You had that local connection.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, imagine hiring some random kid out of Omaha, Nebraska to find out that you and his father went to high school in little bitty Hartford, Wisconsin.
Hartford, Wisconsin. But you came from California, and that was the...
Yeah, yeah.
We thought, oh, he's this Los Angeles guy.
Yeah, you thought I was some big L.A. hotshot. Turns out, no, I was just some Wisconsin boy trying to find my way home, and I did. Small world. Small world. Talking about small worlds, that's kind of the topic of today's podcast, right? Which is the whitetail industry. It's a very small industry. When I first got into it, I didn't know a whole lot about it. I actually didn't know it existed before I got into it. So I've known a little bit, but educate the audience today on when this whitetail industry began. Like, could you narrow it down to a single year?
I can narrow it down to 1973 when it became... incorporated. And I don't say this because I've worked here for 28 years, but it starts with the founders of Deer and Deer Hunting, the Stump Sitters. That's where that I would mark 1973 as the start of the whitetail industry, but the true start was in 1977 when Deer and Deer Hunting became the first media specific whitetail source. Obviously there was whitetail companies out there. But if you look at that history, it's fascinating, like mm-hmm. how it went from guys who deer hunted for a couple days in November, pretty much throughout the country, to the early 70s, to 1977, when these guys just started coming up with ideas, and then, boom, it took off. And so I would say 73 and officially 77 is when things took off. And then I can go through and give you that progression, but things really steamed up every 5-10 year increments after that.
Okay, so you're saying that the Stump Sitters were one of the first organizations to begin that. Now, like, what were these guys? Like, did they go to college to create an industry, right? No, they didn't.
No.
So who were they?
They to correct you, they were the first ones. And that's something that we have to be proud of as an industry, not just right. us working here as an industry. If the Stump Sitters started, what it was is you had... this dates back to the 60s now. This would have been the early to mid 1960s here in Wisconsin. There was a hunting camp. They called themselves the Stump Sitters, and they hunted north of Green Bay, Wisconsin. And two of the members who were the founders of the Stump Sitters were Jack Brower and Al Hofacker. Jack was an insurance salesman. Al was an electrician. They worked hard, and they said, man, wouldn't that be cool if we could like do something hunting for a living? So they but before that happened in 73, they incorporated. So throughout the late 60s, early 70s, they had just local guys, local club members, guys they knew, all wanted to become part of this Stump Sitters group. And all they did was they wanted to learn facts about deer hunting because they wanted to become better deer hunters. So what they did is everybody had logbooks. They wrote in every time they went hunting. I got in the stand at 6 a.m. This is what I saw. And they compiled that data, sent it in. Al was the mastermind behind it because he wanted to really learn exactly the more science behind deer. And he studied journals, wildlife management, that was just scientific literature for biologists. And then he took that data and he really started compiling it. In 73, they incorporated, they thought, well, we got something here. We might have this club that we could do. And then that club went along for, 4 years from 73 to 77. And coincidentally, it's an interesting side note, Richard Smith, who people probably know, one of the most esteemed outdoor writers in history from Upper Michigan.
Never heard of him.
He, if you read the past Deer and Deer Hunting magazines and books, Richard Smith is an icon. He's written many, many books on deer hunting. He was the third member to sign up for the Stump Sitters group. And in 77, he's like, you know, we're sending you all our stuff. We're sending you all our logbook data that we're writing in. He goes like, don't we get like a newsletter or something? Light bulb. Hey, we should start a magazine. So Jack and Al on a kitchen table in Appleton, Wisconsin, came up with the idea. And I always said this is the earliest SEO research. Al's sitting there writing things down, and he goes, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to have stories from the Journal of Wildlife Management to tell you about, you know, about deer behavior and biology and research. And we're going to have stories about hunting and how to and stuff like that. And Jack's like, well, what are we going to call it? And Al kind of went like, well, it's about deer. And it's about deer hunting. Why don't we just call it Deer and Deer Hunting?
Yeah, to be honest, when I first started with DDH, I didn't understand the title either. I was like, why would, like, they're just repeating the word deer twice? It took me a while. And actually, one of our, because when we used to be owned by a corporation out of New York, and we got a new boss who shall not be named. yeah, he's like Voldemort to us, right? He actually, when he interviewed all of us, he's like, I just don't get it, David. Like, deer and deer hunting? What kind of name is that? And I, you know, it was like my first month on the job, and I was like, dude, understand deer, right? Deer biology, deer behavior, you name it. And we deer hunt.
Right.
Right? So, and it's, some people may laugh at it a little bit.
But, and that's,
it's actually...
thing.
You're right. It's a genius SEO search engine.
It is, and that was obviously decades before. But the thing that they were interested in that people still don't understand is it's like the stuff that I'm fascinating in today. Why is a deer's liver blood opaque?
Right.
You know, and they wanted to know why. You know, why how fast can they run? How much saliva do they produce a day? Most people say, well, what does it matter? And I say, once you start understanding all this stuff, it really clicks. Deer behavior, really, you really start understanding about the animal more. And they did it too for people who weren't hunters, who were just photographers, who wanted to learn more about deer.
Right. So you're saying that the guys that created Stump Sitters, yes, they started this magazine, but how did they influence the beginning of the rest of the industry?
Yeah, and that's a thing that I should bring up. It's an excellent point, is that they didn't, you know, it would have happened, right?
Right.
But if you look at, let's back up. You had Fred Bear in the 50s and the 60s. You had H.W. Allen, who invented the compound bow, and he actually patented it in 1966.
Right.
You had all these things coming up. It kind of was there, okay? So right. You had deer hunting with guns. You had bow hunting was starting to take off a little bit. Tom Jennings helped get the compound actually in the market. But if you look at the states, you had... okay, Fred Bear from Michigan, you had H.W. Allen from Missouri, you had Tom Jennings from California, you had people from all over the country, you had the Eastons, you know, you had Pete Shepley from PSE. But it was just kind of there. Well, archery was kind of a novelty.
Yeah.
Gun hunting was the big thing. Jack and Al, they started thinking, no, we want to do this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want to make this a 360 thing. So a couple of things that they, ideas that can be traced back to them, trail cameras.
That's one of the coolest stories you've ever told.
So trail cameras, yeah. this is a cool thing. And when you look at that, okay, first let me back up. So Al was out there with a wind-up alarm clock and a trip wire.
Yeah.
Across deer trails in northern Wisconsin.
Learned that in Vietnam.
And then, you know, something go by and then the clock would stop. And, oh, something came through here at 2 o'clock. There had to be a deer or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's how it started. But then he started doing the same thing with an Olympus camera, a 35 millimeter camera. And we thought, oh my God, that was like really groundbreaking. But if you look in the history of it, George Shearis did this in like 1880,
mm-hmm.
one of the first photographers. He was the first one to get a photo of a deer from a tripwire like that. So that's Al was a historian, and he knew that stuff. So he started doing all this stuff, and I'm going to tell you more stories, but cameras specifically, it started with the trail timer, and everybody remembers trail timers. Anybody who's 50 years old or older remembers a trail timer, but Al came up with the idea. A guy in Keel, Wisconsin, which is right next to Green Bay, mm-hmm. he had the first one. It was called Keel's Trail Timer. And he was a manufacturer, and he did it with a little digital clock, and it was a tripwire. So that kind of went on for a little bit for, I don't know. Okay, so late 70s became popular. You get into the 80s, and then you had a company called Cam Tracker. They were the first one. They were the big ones. They had the first cameras. But Mark Cuddyback, everybody knows Cuddyback cameras.
Yep.
He was like a child prodigy, pretty much. He wasn't that old. 1989 is when he came up with non-typical cameras. And his were big. Mm-hmm. They took the big, mad D batteries, but they were really good. I mean, really good and reliable. And that's how that started. So and when we look about it, when we think about it now, where it's all come from, it was just a guy thinking like, how can I figure out when those deer are coming through here?
Right. And you had guys like Jack who were able and smart enough to look at the history, the breadcrumbs that were kind of left before them, and then take that and then kind of inspire in that 70s and 80s era to really just blow this up into a just global industry.
So let me give you another example would have been camouflage.
Right.
So everybody was using, I'm sure your dad did, army camouflage. That's all they had. And if you had army, well, most guys just wore blue jeans and Carhartts.
I think, it wasn't even that.
Blue jeans and Carhartts, or maybe sitting you had a green shirt or something like that. Yeah. Or you maybe had one of those Jones-style duck hunting hats or something.
Yeah. Go out in a flannel.
But this would have been in the late 70s. So Deer and Deer Hunting had just come out.
Mm-hmm.
A school teacher from Virginia writes a letter to Jack and says, I'm a school teacher, you know, I enjoy my job, but all I really want to do is hunt. You know, what could I do? So this Jack tells me a story. It's like February in 1977 or 78. And Jack goes out to the cemetery in Appleton, Wisconsin with his Olympus camera, and he's taking pictures. See, now let me back up. Before that, Jack and Al made their own camouflage.
Right.
So they went to Herders, which was a sporting goods store, mostly did duck hunting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they bought plain, like, I want to call them Carhartts, but it's like plain overalls.
Right.
And they had a little template with a leaf on it, and they would spray leaves on that clothing. That was really cool camouflage.
Right. Well, I mean, not to knock any camo today, but it probably worked just as good.
It probably worked just as good.
Right.
And guys were doing that with duck boats and blinds and stuff back in the day. Well, Jack goes out with his camera and takes close. Anybody who's old enough is going to know where I'm going with this. Takes close up pictures in winter of tree bark.
Okay. Yeah.
Sends them to the school teacher. The school teacher was Jim Crumley. Jim Crumley is the father of modern day camouflage.
Mm-hmm.
Quit his teaching job, 1980, launched tree bark camouflage, and that really took things to another level. And that is a story that's not often told. But it's like, and then, you know, okay, 6 years after that, Mossy Oak and Realtree started in 86. So, and then you had guys like Bill Jordan and Toxie Hayes who were next level. You know, they were into manufacturing. Mm-hmm. They were into all this stuff. And then, you know, the higher tech stuff, boom, you have modern camouflage.
Gotcha.
So it's an idea that, you know, and it's the same thing with the compound bow. H.W. Allen, that first compound bow was like made out of 2x4s and carved wood and mm-hmm. you know, pulleys that he got at the hardware store. And then Tom Jennings came along and says, listen, he's in California, he's like, I know how to make laminated, I could make laminated limbs, they make these things lighter. So then that took the compound bow, you know. And then that went all the way till, I mean, you had PSE, you had Proline, you had other Martin Archery, you had Jennings, you had all these companies. But then in it would have been in 92 was when Mac McPherson said, I can fix all those timing issues with a single cam bow. And then that took things to the next level.
Okay. So you brought up like Bill Jordan. Question, how many, or if you had to name the founding fathers of the industry, who would they be? Of this modern whitetail hunting.
Okay,
industry.
So we're gonna say Fred Bear, because Fred Bear was a genius.
Everybody knows Fred.
Although Fred thought the idea for deer and deer hunting was stupid. He said there's not enough deer hunters who are going to support a magazine just about whitetails.
But, well, you were wrong, Fred.
Yep.
Wrong about something there, buddy.
But he was a genius, and we love him.
Okay, could shoot the hell out of a black bear. Or
founding fathers, Fred Bear, Hollis Allen, Pete Shepley, Tom Jennings. This is archery. Jim Easton, James Easton, the whole Easton family with, and that starts back in 1922 with archery, with arrows. You'd have to look at the guys at Kamchatka, who I don't even know who that was, but then you'd have to look at Mark Cuddyback, because he was the first one that really, really took things to the next level with cameras.
Right.
Bill Jordan, Toxie Hayes, the guys at Lock On, who I wouldn't know who they're. Rich Maleski from Wasp Archery.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first to mass produce replaceable blade broadheads, which really took things to the next level. I'm obviously going to miss some people in there, but and most of it is archery. I mean, there's a lot with the gun hunting, but archery, even though bow hunters, I love bow hunting. You know that?
Mm-hmm.
Bow hunters, I think of themselves as high and mighty, but bow hunters.
I certainly do.
Bow hunters don't manage our deer herds.
Mm-hmm.
Gun hunters do. But bow hunters help make this industry.
Right.
The whitetail
industry. I mean, every aspect of this industry, right. And every single hunter, I think, helps make the industry, helps continue it on. What about, you talk a lot on the product side of things, right? How we actually turn this into a monetizable industry, yep. Creating products and whatnot. What about the content creators, the people who nowadays you see as the faces of the outdoors, like the Drurys, Jim Shockey. I mean, I know that Jim was like an antique dealer before he ever got into outdoor writing or whatnot, right?
Yep.
So like, where do those guys fit into in terms of like where the industry began and where it is now?
Well, and we'd have to even back up, and I can get into that, but we'd have to back up to the Bob Robs, who he started when the industry was basically just starting in like about 1980.
Right. That's what I'm getting at. Like, who are the names of the people who either don't know, like most people don't know.
Yeah.
I would argue the world doesn't know who Bob Rob is. The people in the industry do. Because he's such
M.R. James with Bowhunter Magazine.
Right.
Bob Rob, he was with Peterson's Bow Hunting, Peterson's Hunting. You have the old gun writers, a lot of them. And if I named them, you I'm going to miss somebody, but, there was, then you got guys like Chuck Adams, you know, he really put a face, there was that celebrity aspect to things. He was killing these big deal, Miles Keller. You start getting later into the 80s, Greg Miller, who was, he was a Wisconsin boy who knew how to hunt big bucks. There were so many people as far as the communicators. And a lot of guys who have passed, Charlie Alzheimer, you know, my friend and colleague for years, John Trout Jr., rest his soul. You had guys who were just excellent, excellent deer hunters who happened to know how to write and communicate. And that's how we did it back then, was through writing. But then when you get to television, you're going to have to credit Bill Jordan with making that sexy, because it was like, you know, it was just VHS cassette tapes back then.
What's that?
Yeah, I know.
I'm just kidding. I actually still have quite a few.
Some kids don't know what it was. And well, even before that, you had cassette tapes. That Jerry Peterson made cassette tapes, instructional deer hunting and turkey hunting cassette tapes.
Yeah. I was born right as cassettes were fading out. So VHS is where I grew up with, and I actually think it's so cool because I still collect like old VHS tapes and VCRs. If I find a working VCR, you have to buy it. In my opinion, but go on. I digress.
The Forbes with Hunter Specialties, they made it very popular. That was where the whole pro staff idea really took off. I knew Pat Reeve when he was a taxidermist.
Yeah,
you know, and he was a pro staffer for them. Things really took off then. Brad Harris, is a name from Missouri. He was one of the first hell of a deer hunter. I mean, just an incredible deer hunter.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of those guys came.
He's the one that made the the like walk decoys, the ones you shoot through.
I don't know who actually made those.
I think
Brad was with Outland Sports. That was a conglomerate back in the early 90s. He was with Lohman Game.
I might
calls.
Be thinking of the wrong guy, but I think because we were just in South Dakota and we were using those, and Brad talked about it. Brad Rucks mentioned who made those.
It might have been. That's actually one that I don't know. It might have been. But the best communicators were guys who were just incredible hunters. Richard Smith again is one of them. You know, gosh, I'm gonna draw blanks here and try to remember everybody, but mostly they were writers. And then you had writers who could cross over to either archery or gun. Bryce Towsley, who we just had on the podcast, one of the first, and just an encyclopedia on firearms and gun hunting. He was, but then it morphed. Okay, so then you got, like you said, you have, oh boy, you've got the juries. They started in the 80s, and you know, Mark was a champion turkey caller. That's how he came up.
Right.
And then you had a lot of guys like that who started these things to what you see today. Lee Lakoski, he was an engineer on a like an oil rig, from what I remember. Mm-hmm. He wrote stories for us, and he was a brilliant mind in how to get into this, because I was fairly new.
Right.
And he got a hold of me. He said, Dan, I want to write stories for you and give you photos. And this guy was killing 150-inch deer, which were just giants. Mm-hmm. And he goes, I'm going to give you the stories and photos for free. I just want you to use one of my photos with art. He knew that if he branded himself, that he could get within the industry. And he did a wonderful job with
it. Right. And that's one of the smartest like stories you've ever told me, was that, okay, yeah, that's back in the day when you guys were spending how much on
$15,000 a year issue on a magazine.
On a magazine for photos.
Photos was about half of that. But okay. Yeah.
Still, $7,500 a year, mm-hmm, or whatever on photos. Here comes an issue.
Yeah.
And you got 10 issues a year. So, and then you got Lee Lakoski, who comes in and says, here's all of mine for free. All I ask is that you accredit me.
Yep.
And then boom, he's the biggest name.
Yeah. Well, and he worked for it.
Or at least it gets there, right?
Yeah, and so, I always said,
what you have to do to get there. And a lot of people don't get that. A lot of people are like, I'm on pro staff now. I'm there.
Oh,
I made it.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a good point, because people say, well, I love to hunt. And I love to, and I can kill big deer. Yeah, well, congratulations, right. But you have to have a skill,
right?
And just because you love to hunt doesn't mean you're going to have a job. Right. Number one, and number two, you've got to want it way more. And Lee wanted it. Pat Reeves, another example. I probably told you that story,
mm-hmm,
but Pat was a guide, out in Buffalo County, part-time guide. He was a taxidermist. He was doing everything else, and he did the same thing. But man, that dude wanted it way more than, I remember as clear as day, he had bought a brand new Sony Handycam. This would have been in about, I can't remember, it was like 1995 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I'm going to film myself killing a turkey. Wouldn't that be cool? I'm like, yeah, that'd be cool, but I just want to kill a turkey, you know?
Yeah.
And he showed me, he guided me, and he said, go up on this ridge tomorrow. And I actually did and shot a turkey, called it, and thought it was awesome. But he learned that camera. He learned exactly how to do it, and he became a master at it. And he wanted it,
right?
Wanted it really bad. He, you know, and Lee did too. I mean, Tiffany was a stewardess for Northwest Airlines. I mean, they just gave up both the things that they had trained their entire young lives for,
mm-hmm,
to chase that dream.
Right.
But yeah. So I mean, there's plenty of examples like that. Could that happen today? I see a lot of people trying. A lot more difficult. You see it too. A lot of people trying.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people out there who still don't understand that you have to be willing to give your stuff away for free the way that Lee did, in order to just get your name out there, right?
Years.
And but now people think, I get a little bit of attention and I'm worth this. No, you're not. Sorry.
Yeah. I got X amount of likes. I got 10,000 likes. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Great.
Okay. So, but kind of on that topic. So you've got these people who gave up everything in an emerging industry to kind of add a media element to it, right? You got the Lee Lakoski, you've got the Drewies, what's his name? Jim Shockey.
Shockey, yeah.
who went from an antique dealer to
a writer. Making $200 an article for
right,
years.
Right, so these people gave this up. I'm gonna get a little deep here on you in question. The success that these people have found, they're all good people, they're all great people, they're friends of yours, they're friends of the magazines, did blowing it up into a TV industry, into a multimedia industry, do anything to damage hunting culture as a whole, in your opinion?
Wow, that is a deep question.
'Cause I'm a newcomer, and in the last 6 years, I've seen a lot of good. But I've also kind of witnessed a lot of the negative effects of what that's kind of created. And I'm a big believer that, you know, I'm a movie buff first and foremost. So you go back to The Dark Knight, what does Harvey Dent say, right? He says you either live long enough, or you either die the hero, or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain. Has the outdoor industry lived long enough to see itself become the villain?
In some aspects, yes. In some aspects, yes. I see a lot of stuff today that you know, Charlie, rest his soul.
Yeah.
He would just, I could just see him just shaking his head right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and this isn't me waxing poetic. It's just to get to this juncture, you know, money is going to corrupt people.
Right.
And now that we have an industry, there's going to be certain aspects of that. And I would agree with you that there are aspects, for the most part, no, because for the most part, I think, you know, like I said, if you look at it from a macro level, hunting is still portrayed on a good level, but there's a lot of the stuff that is, especially with social media, it's just, it's cringeworthy. Thankfully, we actually have some grassroots guys trying to fight that tide and to...
Right, I think YouTube has kind of helped a lot with
that. To call people out, you know?
Yeah.
And the fact that you can comment on a video and, I don't want to say be a troll, but you can comment on a video and call somebody out for their nonsense, I think does help. But yeah, I mean, there's some stuff here that I don't like. Stuff I see in the industry that I just think that, no, we're grasping at straws here. Okay, guys, we're going to take a break to thank one of our sponsors. Hit record and win rewards. Enter the Apex Whitetail Challenge in your state for your opportunity to win big cash. Enter today and get a 4K camera absolutely free. That is right, a $300 value camera absolutely free. Reserve your spot today at apexoutdoorrewards.com. So I'm gonna tell you about this a little bit. If you enter the challenge, you get one whitetail entry for each challenge. You get a 4K digital camera free, a mounting bracket for the camera, two rolls of antler measuring tape, a 32 gigabyte SD card, a USB charging cable, and a 90 minute battery with wall charger. That's all included in this, and you have an opportunity to win big cash. Check it out again at apexoutdoorrewards.com.
The outdoor industry, I would argue, is one of the most grounded industries with the most grounded human beings on planet Earth, right? You're right, money corrupts and whatnot. And I've heard you say before that the TV industry ruined hunting, right? Because people see nothing but 170, 200 inch deer, and it makes them believe that that's what they can do at their, you know, personal 40 acres in northern Wisconsin. And it's just not true. So, I mean, I would argue that as great as it is, and as much as I want this industry to be around forever, it does kind of need to check itself and go back to that grounded beginning a little bit.
100% agree. And you know, I've fought for that my entire career. Yep. I've made enemies that way. And Ted tells you, if you're not pissing people off, you know, now here's one that's going to be a little controversial.
Yeah.
I love and that. I even hesitate saying this, but there is an aspect, and I don't think anybody's going to disagree with me, that there's a segment of deer hunting that is pornography. You know, it's like, it's big bucks, big bucks, yeah, big bucks, and now you're desensitized to a fork or a spike, which your dad and I would have, like, tripped over ourselves to kill in 1983.
Yeah.
You know, and...
it's Pornhub, man.
Exactly. Exactly. And we see it today with the idol worship on social media.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody gets busted for poaching and they still got thousands of people backing them, you know.
You got someone in mind there?
No, they're just talking in generalities.
Right.
And and that's the thing. And when I said television ruined it,
mm-hmm,
yes, but another controversial one, trophy buck management ruined it.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like, here's where I look at it, because I could do another podcast just on this, but we always said, you know, okay, quality deer management. I'm not going to pull any punches. People took the aspects of that in its whole, great concept, awesome concept, but people don't care about the awesome concept. The mass majority does not care about the mass. They want, I want a big buck. And that's how Gary Alt sold it to Pennsylvania. No offense to Gary Alt, but he sold it to Pennsylvania. You're going to have bigger bucks to hunt if you knock these deer densities down, which we have to do scientifically, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, who does that benefit? It benefits two segments of our community. It benefits the state, and it benefits larger landowners. Let me go through them real quick. It benefits the state in the fact that you're doing their bidding and you have to, but the state doesn't care. The state will not love you back. Just because, and I've killed 10 does a year for the past 28 years. The state doesn't love me back for doing that. I'm helping them keep that population down.
Mm-hmm.
But you know me, I've hunted 6 acres, I've hunted 9 acres, I've hunted 28 acres. I'm hunting small properties. I'm killing all these does. Who's benefiting from it? The larger landowners. Depends upon your habitat, depends upon where you're at. But they're getting those bigger bucks. That's fine. That's the bet I made from that. But television comes along. Who's hunting on TV? Guys that have access to good land. Well, I'm right. Hunting the best properties. I know that.
Not everybody on TV has access to good land. Especially you.
But the yes, true. But the ones that we're seeing there are killing big bucks.
Yeah. Yeah, the most popular ones. So the ones that are really blown up.
You got some guy sitting in, you know, Hannibal, Missouri, who's hunting 10 acres. Well, I'm holding out for 150, man. And that is embedded in their brain.
Yep.
Because that's all they see on television.
Right.
That's all they see on television. Big buck, big buck. Oh, it's got to be 4.5 years old. You're not doing that on the small properties.
Right.
So has it ruined deer hunting totally? No, it hasn't ruined deer hunting totally. But it has created horn fantasies that are just not attainable for the mass, you know, 11 million deer hunters out there. 11 million right. People can't be Lee Likoski.
Right.
There's only going to be a couple Lee Likoskis. And you can aspire for that, but you better keep that in mind. It's like, no, I'm just a chump hunting 6 acres in Waupaca, Wisconsin.
And be happy with what's available to you, You can get. Absolutely. Okay, we definitely digressed a little bit there.
Yeah, we did.
That's okay. So the industry began with these guys who basically were hunters, hobbyists who blew this thing up. Where does it sit now, you know, outside of TV and the media? You think this industry's got another 40, 50 years in it?
Oh, definitely. The thing with the hunting industry, though, is I see very parallel scenario with the fishing industry.
Mm-hmm.
So what you saw with the fishing industry probably a good 20 years before us. When I first got here, when we did the equipment annual, it was 248 pages, and I bet you we had 75 different advertisers in there.
Yeah.
It became corporate. Companies pick up other companies, can pick up other companies. Now you've got some big conglomerates, and that's what you had in fishing. So from the industry standpoint, I think it's still going to be healthy, but it's not going to be the way that I grew up.
Right.
In the fact that you had, well, especially when those guys started, okay, you got to had a guy with an idea. Then some guy figures, hey, I can do this trail timer. Then another guy says, well, I can take that and I can do a camera. And the other guy says, well, I can make it digital. Oh, I can send it to your phone.
Right.
Well, all that stuff is kind of reached its peak in most of these areas. And now you've got, you know, 6, 8, 10, 15 different conglomerates that own 20 different brands.
That own 80% of the industry.
Right.
Now, yeah.
And that's how the fishing industry is.
That said, you know, I haven't worked in too many industries prior to the hunting industry, but what I have noticed and what I really like is, like, you go to the ATA show, archery trade show, every single year, and you see new booths every year of just mom and pop shops who came up with a new product, you know, just solo owners just trying to get their thing out there. And I would argue that, yeah, you got some of that in other industries, but you probably got it a little bit more in this industry. It's a little more predominant still. And as much as I know the people at these larger conglomerates and I like them very much, I do sometimes just think like, oh man, they bought another one.
Yeah, well,
you know,
well,
like,
yeah.
Like I support them no matter what because they're in the industry and they're keeping the industry alive. But at the same time, I love the fact that this industry encourages you or me to create a product and to start one, right? And I would like to think that if I ever did, I would hold on to it no matter what. But the truth is, I'd probably sell out too, so.
Yeah, and like you said, you see that in other industries. But it is still kind of like a, you know, what is that show? I don't watch too much TV, but like the Shark Tank, where people come up with like,
yeah,
they're coming up with a better mousetrap. Some people are, or they're coming up with a new idea. And you see it with app. It's different stuff now, though. You see it with apps.
Right.
You know, you're seeing it with other things, but you do still see some things where it's like, you know, dang, that's that. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, and trying to solve a problem. To your point, we live in such a competitive market now that is very expensive to thrive in if you are starting out, that you almost need that bigger money just to get you, your company, to the next step. So I'm not harking on them per se, but it's just, I love, just like anybody, I think listening probably does love the fact that American small business is where not only this industry continues to live on, but the middle class continues to live on.
Yeah, I think you're right. The golden age probably was, excuse me, probably I'd say 1986 to about, just say 96, that 10-year span.
Yeah.
There's, I mean, it's like, dang, you look at all the companies that came out in that time.
Yeah.
Wow. And it I don't see we're going to, and then it just kind of snowballed.
Yeah.
So they came, they were strong, they got big. I don't think we're going to see that anymore. Well, I still think we're going to see what you're talking about, right. The smaller ideas coming to big, you know, to mid-sized companies.
So giving a specific example, I won't name the company. It no longer exists, but I won't name it. If you want to, go ahead. I don't know that much about it, but I know a lot of people who worked there. And this was a media company just like us, right, creating TV shows and whatnot. And they operated during that peak, during that golden age, as everybody always, I mean, imagine being my age coming into it in 2017 and everyone being like, man, it used to be so great. Like, I just love how this industry used to spend money frivolously here and there, and we all made a lot, and it was just beautiful. And I'm just like, well, story of my life, yeah. You know, get into a new industry, everyone's all excited, and then you're like, hey, hiring freeze, and yeah. Everything's going down, right? So, I mean, like, what happened to leave the golden age? Like, what did those companies who either are no longer here or they filed for bankruptcy and they just keep on trudging on, what did they do?
How did it get that far?
Yeah.
I think it's a natural progression, basically, with any industry. I think what happened is on a lot of these cases, well, it could have been just poor management on the company standpoint, which I think did happen a lot. And that goes to the point where I was talking about, you see a best story I ever had. Actually, Pat Boyle, if you're listening to this, I got to give Pat the credit, because I was with Pat and we were at a guy's booth at ATA. And this is, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And we went up there and Pat said, you know, how are you doing? How's your year? And he goes, well, Pat, I finally made it. Wait, what do you mean? Got myself a Ford F-250. And he's like,
heck yeah.
What? And he goes, I mean, this guy had a company, and he was like, that was your aspirations for your company, so you could buy yourself a new pickup truck? And he was true. The guy loved hunting so much that he lost sight of managing a business. And I think that's what happened with some of these companies. In other cases, I think it was just a progression of you had guys that started companies that got them big in that golden age, but they got older and they got enough money there. It's like, you know.
Would you say that they kind of like held it on and didn't pass that on to the next generation, how to keep it going?
Yep.
Because I
see that a lot.
Yeah, I read a lot of business books behind your back so I could take this whole thing over one day. and I've read that a lot of companies that have failed failed because of that reason, because the CEOs decided, I'm just going to take my winnings and I'm going to leave, and I'm not going to hire, I'm not going to train, I'm not going to pass this on so that it continues.
And didn't embrace, you know, that would have happened to us had we not embraced the digital age.
Well, I mean, it did happen to our parent company at one point, mm-hmm. right? We're one of the lucky ones where at least some of our employees during that golden age banked that earning. And then they bought us. And now we're back to my favorite thing in the world, which is a small business.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a freaking grind, man. But I feel like we returned to the heart of what the outdoor industry was built out of, which was a bunch of guys who just love what they do. You hunting, writing, Brad hunting and selling, you know, me, again, more of a movie geek than a hunter, But I get to sit here and I get to create stories every single day without just miles and miles of red tape that, you know, we're holding us back beforehand.
Right. But also embracing the technology or embracing whatever the trends are. Not to say that those trends are going to be home runs.
Right.
But if you just sit and do the same thing eventually, that's with any company. If you just sit and do the same thing over and over and over again, there's a million examples in America where they didn't, like you said, our first parent company, mm-hmm. You've heard that story. We sat in a boardroom when this thing called the internet came along, and the famous quote from the president of the company at the time says, "No, we're not going to invest into that because we think it's the CB radio of the 1990s. That was his quote in a company meeting.
Well, our current president thought you were wasting your time on Facebook when that started. Yeah, Dan's still eating those words.
Dan's screwing around on Facebook.
Yeah. He's still screwing around on Facebook.
But thankfully, in that environment, we did have some people saying, no, just keep doing that, because you can't just keep doing the same thing over and over. Because things do cycle through.
Right.
And that's why we are 360. And 360 is going to help you in this business or any other business.
Right. So how do you, like, one of the comments that we get the most, which is, I'll just flat out say it, it's annoying to me, right, is that we are sellouts because we're advertising so much. People just want straight deer content. I will flat out put myself on the line and say, guess what? Without the advertising, you don't get the content. Without the content, the industry's gone.
Yeah.
Right.
That's with any media.
So, right. And so, I mean, I don't know where I'm really necessarily going with that, but I wanted to say it.
No. And you have to say it in a media industry. It's not even media. Look at the National Football League.
Yeah.
They're playing games in London. You think they're doing that because they want to just, no, they want to build that. They don't want to stay stagnant, because if they stay stagnant, they're going to die.
Yeah.
And they have deals, and everybody expects that. They expect it with a podcast. Listen to Joe Rogan. Mm-hmm. Without advertising, you're not going to be able to listen to him and have the guests that he gets on there. You're not going to be able to do it.
The thing is, when you're as big as Joe Rogan, people tend not to care that you have advertisers.
That's the thing.
They're just like, well, it's Joe Rogan, so I'll listen to this ad. Why not? Matter of fact, I'll buy it too.
Yeah. And if... It kind of bothers me on many levels, because I grew up in newspapers, as you know, and newspapers died a fast death.
First job after college was with a newspaper.
Well, there we go.
Yeah, Omaha World Herald.
You're not as young as you think you are.
Yeah.
And they did not embrace, they thought, well, we'll just put stuff behind a paywall and people are going to want to pay to read about the Packers game from yesterday. No, well, some do. Mm-hmm. Not enough to keep you in business.
Yeah.
Not enough to keep the lights on and everything. Things cost money. So I think we do, coming back to your point, I think we do it in a way that is beneficial to the consumer, because, right, yes, we have, I'm wearing logoed apparel. Well, you can just choose not to listen or to look at that. But the other thing too is, okay, we're showing you products. Some of those are paid placements, but I don't think it's gratuitous. And I think that's where you can draw the line, where it's like, if you're not being overly gratuitous, people will, like you say, accept it and understand that everything's got to come. If you're sitting there watching it for free on your phone or your laptop, somebody's got to be paying those bills.
So would you say that it's fair for me to posit that we, as the media in this industry, in a world where PETA is constantly trying to attack us and lobby for laws that damage this industry, and social media is growing so big and the hunting portion of it is growing smaller and smaller, and land is becoming more less accessible to the average guy, we in the media are somewhat, and this is kind of patting ourselves on the back here, but somewhat the front line to survival of this industry. So I kind of ask those guys that sit there and hark on us for having advertisers, like, dude, we're the ones fighting for you, as hard, as tirelessly as we can. I'm also fighting to support my family, to put food on the table. I've got a baby on the way, right? But at the end of the day, it's one of the things I love about this industry is the guys that are in it, they made it, right? You know most of the guys that began this whole thing. And so you're tied to it. You know, it's a part of who you are. And so you're going to fight for it and probably be the editor of DDH till you're 89 if you can.
I hope so.
Right? So,
I'll be coming in here in a wheelchair. But
yeah, the overall point just being that, like, we're the forefront. We're the guys trying to save this for the future generations. And I'm not asking for credit, but I'm asking, at least those of you that like to get on our backs about the one or two ads you got to suffer through, please just shut up.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree that as a media member, you have to take that responsibility.
Yeah.
And as a consumer. But I would also expand what you say there is that just even if you're a person with a Facebook or an Instagram or even a TikTok, to get to your point about anti-hunting, this is something that we talked about way before I was here, but from a hunting community, you've got to portray yourself ethically.
Yeah.
Play by the rules and then promote. I know how it is. And we go back to that bad analogy that we talked about before. The things that might seem most shocking are what get the most responses. If you have anything in your soul at all that you want to keep this going, promote ethical hunting, promote the use of that wild protein.
Mm-hmm.
And that will continue to send the message to the non-hunting public, which is the public that we care about, that yes, hunting is what it is, what we say it is.
Yeah.
And we don't have to sit there and cower and hide behind the enjoyment in that lifestyle. It's not a sport. It's a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle that I choose to go out and get free-ranging protein.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you don't need to do that. Well, you don't need to grow a vegetable garden either, but why do you? And there's 36 million gardeners in America. That is a lifestyle that you choose, just as this lifestyle is. But you have to show some kind of, I know it's the youthful arrogance in people love to show a picture of them laying on the ground with a dead deer with its tongue hanging out and they're doing something weird. It's like, you might think that's funny. Your friends might think it's funny, but you have to think beyond that. And I think a lot of people have a problem doing that, but it's from the advertising standpoint. I don't worry about it because, you know, we're not doing it solely for that. We're doing it because yes, everything has a cost, and yes, people are going to understand that, you know, we have product placement for a reason. Seinfeld did it.
Yeah.
You see Kramer drinking a Pepsi, you think that was by accident? No, they were paying him to do that.
Right.
So everything is kind of similar that way.
Right. Well, man, I know if I keep talking, I'm going to get myself in trouble. So,
well, that would be okay.
Because again, I'm not an authority on any of this, so I'm perfectly fine if people watching or listening hate me. It's cool.
They should not hate you.
I agree.
The thing that I want to emphasize from before is when you look at the hunting industry, how it started.
Yeah.
If you're into history at all, just look into that, and you're going to see how people from all these different states came together and created this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just one person. It's not just one company. It was people. And what you said, it was salt of the earth people.
Yep.
with the common interest, and how that all came together is pretty fascinating. Because you really don't see that too often. I mean, you can look at any other industry. Yeah, there might have been people with like business minds, but this is a culture. Hunting is a culture, and I think it's cool. I just love everybody from all the different areas. Because everybody does have their own mind. The other thing that I would add in there, though, is social media really is good at eliciting negative responses in people. And I'd always say, I have that, you've probably seen it on my computer, don't respond. I have that on a post-it note, don't respond.
I've yelled at you for sending me the one negative comment on my videos over and over again. Like, Dan,
yep,
one dude.
It. Yep.
Look at how many likes it's got compared to the one negative guy who's like, hey, that audio was a little low,
yeah,
buddy. Or that music was just a tad bit high, buddy.
Could you please, with the music, we don't need to listen to music when a deer's walking it. No, I get it.
Yeah.
So. Don't respond, but also, Well, that's pretty much it. Don't respond and don't lower yourself. A good quote: the eagle doesn't hunt the sparrow. If you got some rock farmer sitting there pitching stones at you, you know you're above that.
Yeah.
And ignoring somebody sometimes is the best response. It's just no response.
All right. So it was an industry built by your neighbors, by your doctor, by your engineer, and it is definitely an industry that I, again, only being 6 years into it, I think it is worth fighting for, worth keeping alive as long as we possibly can, because I think it's one of the only grounded ones out there left, you know, the ones that hadn't completely been taken over by corruption and greed and whatnot. So, yeah. Hats off to you, man. Keep fighting the good fight.
I agree.
Suck it. Let's go.
You can't end a podcast like that.
Yeah, I can.
This episode is brought to you by Drop Tine Spirits and their premium 12-point bourbon whiskey. The story of Drop Tine's finest bourbon starts with being double barrel aged. What this means is they first aged the bourbon in new charred oak barrels in America's heartland, then send it to California to be finished in the salt air of the Pacific in the finest brandy barrels. Finishing their bourbon in brandy barrels was the choice of many trials to find flavors as unique as the Drop Tine Deer. They wanted a bourbon that is not only warm to the palate, but it would sip smoothly and leave notes of fruit behind. They found the perfect brandy barrels in the Russian River Valley near Sonoma, California, and what they created is a bourbon whiskey that exhibits a sweet, floral, almost honey-like aroma balanced by caramel, toasted wood, brown sugar, and toffee. 12 Point Bourbon is only available online. To get a taste for yourself after the hunt, visit droptine.com. Deer Talk Now is also brought to you by Hunt Stand and the new Hunt Stand Pro app. Let me tell you, I've been using the Hunt Stand app for a couple seasons now, and I can honestly say it has changed the way I hunt. There's no more guessing on wind direction, property lines, and stand locations. The app takes my hunting to precise new levels that help me be more successful. The new Hunt Stand Pro app unlocks unlimited property data on a nationwide basis, including detailed property boundaries throughout the United States and most of Canada, including property owners' names in the United States, with detailed ownership information. You can also access detailed public land maps and search for properties on a county, state, or province level. There are so many features that also help you dial in on the best spots based on weather conditions. For more information, visit the App Store or log on to huntstand.com. This podcast is brought to you by Cuddyback Cameras. I'm going to tell you guys, I've known Mark Cuddyback personally for over 20 years, and I've been using those cameras for over 18 years on Deer and Deer Hunting TV. The recent technology in the past few years has absolutely blown me away, and for those of you who don't have great cell coverage where you hunt, Cuddyback's ability to daisy chain from one camera to another camera with new CuddyLink technology is an absolute lifesaver. With the ability to connect 24 cameras, I place one home base camera at the edge of my property, swap that card out just once a month, and I get a look at all the activity on my entire property. My deer stay unpressured and the conditions are prime for opening day of bow season. For those of you who have the luxury of cell service, check out their new Cuddyback Tracks technology. This is game changing. For more information, go to cuddyback.com. Deer Talk is also brought to you by Traditions Firearms, a family-owned business and inventor of the new Nitro Fire muzzleloader. When owner and president Tom Hall and his daughter Allison first showed me the Nitro Fire system, I was immediately impressed that it is not only more convenient than conventional muzzleloaders, but it is safer. The ability to quickly remove the powder charge is a big deal, such as when crossing a fence, climbing into or out of a tree stand, transporting your rifle in a truck or an ATV, or when hiking rough hills, wading creeks, or plunging through swamps. I've used the Nitro Fire on numerous Deer and Deer Hunting TV hunts over the past 2 years, and I find it safe, accurate, and very dependable. The gun is available in numerous configurations. To learn more, visit traditionsfirearms.com. The Deer Talk Now podcast is also brought to you by Apex Outdoor Rewards. Hit record and win rewards. Enter the Apex Whitetail Challenge in your state for your opportunity to win big cash. Enter today and get a 4K camera absolutely free. That's a $300 value absolutely free. There are some serious rewards here, guys, so be sure to enter in your state. Who would have thought your next buck could be putting money in your pocket? Reserve your spot today at apexoutdoorrewards.com. The Deer Talk Now podcast is also brought to you by Full Range Mounting Systems. These mounting systems are a great way to manage all of your mounts in a stylish and organized manner. We are using their pedestal mount here on the podcast set for two shoulder mounts, and it looks just awesome. Be sure to check out all their mounting solutions at fullrangesystems.com. And finally, Deer Talk Now is brought to you by 10 Point Crossbow Technologies. Hey, if you've watched me on Deer and Deer Hunting TV, you know that I'm an equal opportunity bow hunter, and for most of the past decade, that has also included crossbows. In fact, I shot my first crossbow deer with a 10 point over 12 years ago, and to say that I've been impressed with their technology is an understatement. This year, I'm shooting the new Nitro 505, the fastest crossbow in the world. It is light, compact, and includes the revolutionary AccuSlide cocking and decocking technology. Whether I'm in a tree stand, ground blind, or spot and stalk hunting, I know the Nitro 505 is up to any challenge. Check one out at a dealer near you or log on to 10pointcrossbows.com for more information.